Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
The talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, part two of Gang Violence, Are Your Colors Worth Dying For? I'm Carrie Hines, your host. In researching for today's show, I went to gangwar.com. That's a website run by Steve Novacek, who was a guest on part one of Gang Violence. It mentioned on that site that sociologists as well as gang members have said that there are several reasons kids join gangs. Identity, discipline, recognition, love, belonging, and money. It went on to say that fear and hatred, bigotry, poverty, disenfranchisement, and general breakdown of social values are also considered motivations. that's when it occurred to me that if a child was well socialized, meaning affiliated with organizations like the ones I'm going to introduce to you today, as well as connected to, say, a church, involved in sports, all of these needs would be met with the exception of money. That's why I'm excited about introducing today's panel. These organizations are in different parts of the country. However, they address a need that the kids that are attracted to these gangs, the needs can be met with these particular organizations. But before we begin, let me say that our prayers go out to the people over in Egypt. We're hoping that they find a resolution to their demands really soon. A reminder that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or our hosts. At this time, I'd like to introduce my panel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Sally Hazelgrove. She's founder of Restoring the Path Program. That's in Englewood, a section of Chicago, that deals with teaching kids boxing as an alternative to gang violence. Also, we have Mr. Melvin Carter. He's director of the Boys and Girls Club here in the Fort Worth, Texas area. We also have Robert Lewis Jr. He's VP of Boston Foundation Program. That also underneath them has, underneath that umbrella is Street Safe Boston, which is a very interesting program, and I'm going to let him tell you more about that. And our last guest, but not least, is Mr. LaFell Jackson. He's an ex-Crip leader of the original Gangster Crips out of Little Rock, Arkansas. And he's also founder of ROCAN, which is an organization dealing with reaching out to children and the neighborhood is what the call letters stand for. Each of you organizations have been designed to keep, as I said, at-risk youth off the street and away from gangs. I'm going to open up everyone's phone line and say good afternoon to everyone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Is everyone present?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Yes, we are.
I'm going to start off by talking or wanting you all to talk about the gang violence in your area. We'll start with Sally Hazelgrove. Sally, I remember in 2010, Chicago was a hotbed for gang violence and just violence in general. Can you tell us a little bit about the occurrences of violence in 2010 in the Chicago area?
Sure. Well, it's pretty much, you know, the violence has been obviously centralized in our inner city areas where the factors you spoke about, the poverty, lack of a good education, lack of outlets for our youth. And I completely agree with what you said that, you know, the sense of belonging, the unconditional love, the respect, and these reasons for kids and youth being so easy to join gangs. And also, I've always said I give credit to the gang leaders because they're really the only ones I see out on the corners recruiting. And my whole thing has kind of been, where is everybody? But we experience quite a lot of violence, and it's just an epidemic. And it's very systematic, and we are a very segregated city, which I think hurts all cities that are segregated like Chicago, because the facts are that white America controls, you know, at least 90% of the wealth.
Tell us a little bit about Restoring the Path program. What are you all doing to help at-risk youth?
Well, Restoring the Path, my mission is, you know, our mission is to restore the path of youth engaging in negative behavior due to gang affiliation and activity by providing boxing, mentoring, spiritual development, and love. And my philosophy is basically every young man I see, first and foremost, I say, what if this was my child? I have, you know, four children of my own. And secondly, I accept youth exactly as they are, meaning if they're cursing, smoking weed, being defiant, disrespectful, et cetera. And I believe, you know, we need to accept them exactly as they are to bring them up to where we want them to be. Boxing, I chose boxing because I actually surveyed the neighborhood in 2004, and I went around asking all the boys on the corner, you know, what sport would you most like access to that you don't have? And boxing came up about 90%, and I love to fight, so I'm blessed by God that boxing is how I basically get their attention, because I feel the street is addictive, and there's a certain burning in the street, you know, and I felt like you have to find a light that burns brighter than the street, first of all, to get their attention. Because if you don't have their attention and their interest, you can't mentor them and get them into church and get them to have a different value system and get them to feel that sense of belonging, et cetera, and love. And I have a huge waiting list, but I think it's basically because they want to belong. They want to belong to something. And the gang does provide that.
Okay. Melvin Carter, you're the director of the Boys and Girls Club here in Fort Worth, Texas. Tell us about the gang violence in Fort Worth.
Well, the gang violence is, as you guess, it's a require. We've had our ups and our downs, and we're now at the, I think, at the point of whenever the economy takes a bad turn, you started getting more violence in the neighborhoods, and of course, that you get more kids joining gangs or doing other things that are outside the nature of them as individuals. All the things that you mentioned earlier definitely attributed to the gang problem, but we can't get to the point where, and I think a lot of people want to address the issues of gang violence or poverty and put a face on it. I do believe that there are other Americans across are suffering from the same issues that we're suffering from.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, the let's just take, for instance, I don't want to pick a particular political party, but back in the day there was, there was the Ku Klux Klan that kind of resembles some of the things we see now in some of these political parties that we have. All these things are fostering and have our kids looking at and weighing what America is all about now. And again, Fort Worth is no different than Chicago or any other area. We just speak a little slower.
Let me ask you this. What does the Boys and Girls Club do to keep kids off the street?
We find, again, we assess the neighborhood. We assess what is going on in that neighborhood, and we try to address the issues. Right now, we're trying to address the issues of education. Education is a big topic right now all across the country, but it also is a big issue in our neighborhoods. Our kids are not being educated, and they're dropping out of school, and so that's our first issue of business. Well, I won't say that's our first issue, because then we got to take care of their social needs. We first have to figure out if they're hungry. Or something else is going on in their lives, and we immediately try to address those issues. Then we address, you know, of course, the educational needs or whatever needs that we need to address. But that's basically what we're doing. The number one priority in Fort Worth now is how do we redirect and educate our kids.
Okay. Mr. Robert Lewis, you're the VP of Boston Foundation, which also has a program called Street Safe Boston. First of all, tell us how the gang violence is in Boston, and then tell us what Street Safe Boston is all about.
Right. First of all, thank you for having the show. And it's interesting, and I hope folks remind, I'm in my car holding this call, and we have about 40 young people in another area that are just off the street. What we basically did was we took a look at the violence over the years. In 1990, I started the first gang program here in Boston called the Street Workers Program, and we've been taking a look at what's been the effect of street work and other services in our communities. There was a recent report that came out that it wasn't shocking anyone when you took a look at that, you know, 78% of the shootings and the murders and aggravated assaults happen in less than, you know, 1% or about 2% of the landmass of our city. Mm-hmm. So when you start to think of the 16 to 24-year-olds, mm-hmm. we took a look at the data that says we know exactly when it happens, where it happens, who's doing it, and the data's been there, and the shootings are happening, you know, between the hours of 8 and 2 in the morning, but 80% of the nonprofits in Boston are closed by 7. We know these kids, and it's been a historical track for the last 30 years. So the data wasn't different. What we decided to do is we decided that we were going to take the best of street work, the best of services, and we made a decision that we weren't going to rely on the government. And a year and a half ago, I launched this $20 million campaign that I would raise $20 million in 5 years to fund this program so it wasn't dependent on the government.
Mm-hmm.
We're a year and a half into it, and I've raised $11 million of private money
Wow.
for this initiative. And the whole focus of this is we're working with the shooters. We're getting to put the guns down and stop killings. And the thing that we've been able to do is to work with the business community around jobs so that someone's criminal offender record wouldn't have an impact on our young folks. And 80% of the workers I hired, I probably have staffed up about 40 workers. About 80% of them have had priors for many, many years, but who have turned their life around. So what we're looking to do is make sure that our young folks are getting educated, they're getting access to jobs, real jobs that are going to sustain themselves. And we want to make sure, too, that we're working with the nonprofit sector in Boston in terms of helping to shift the way that, one, they either reach out to this population, two, provide them with the training and the resources they need to work with this population, and that the third thing is to identify that these young folks are part of our community. Because when we really take a look at across the board, how many young folks are the real impact players in Boston? It's only about 500.
Wow.
500 across the city.
So
again,
you all
know
who the problem people are.
We know who they are. We know where the crime happens. We know exactly the time. And, again, that's been a 30-year history. And what we have made a decision on is to address that. And so far our work with the Boston Medical Center, the police department, the private sector, and others has been a step. And what we have seen in just the first year's data, as crime is sort of like gone up in Boston. The interesting thing, with the gang members that we are working with in Boston, crime has been reduced by 20%.
Okay, let me ask you to explain to everyone about the fact that your program goes out into the field when there is a situation of a gang shooting. Can you explain to them how you all go about doing that?
I think there's a couple of things, and like what I know others probably do around the country. Our workers don't work in neighborhoods. They work with gangs. They stay with the gangs. They know them. As a matter of fact, most of our workers were folks who were from that neighborhood and from that block many, many years ago. What we are doing is if an incident happens, one, we're out there. Two, we already are, you know, we have a great relationship with our local hospital that we're already doing gang intervention. We're able to find out what the situation was, why it happened, to be able to squash this within 24 hours. And one of the things that I don't talk a lot about is we actually have a safe house. We have a safe house, so when some of the young folks want to talk or they feel like they have to get off the block, we do that. So our workers are out there on the street from 4 to 2 in the morning. They're on call 24/7. They're at court. They're anywhere these young folks are going. We check on them while they're working, and we're making sure that we are providing stipends to them for housing, because a lot of folks know if you come out of jail, you know, one of the biggest things besides getting a job, you don't have, with your criminal record, you can't get housing. So we're working with housing. We're doing the trauma work. We wanted to make sure that we were putting the money and the resources exactly where the young folks are. We say we don't fund the organizations. We put the money, and the money follows the young people. And that's what we want to make sure, is that we won't partner with anyone unless they're committed to partnering with this 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. LaFell Jackson, you are an ex-leader of the original Gangsta Crip set in Little Rock, Arkansas. You also were featured in the 1994 HBO documentary Gang War, Banging in Little Rock. But after 10 years in federal prison, you've changed your life around, founded ROCAN, which is Reaching Our Children and Neighborhoods. Tell us how the gang violence is in Little Rock and what you and your organization do to keep kids off the street.
Thank you. First of all, I want to commend everyone that that's on the panel who's been reaching out to our youth. It's amazing because you get to working so hard, and you'll think that you're the only one doing work to help stop our youth from killing each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to commend everyone. I think that at the end of the day, I rocking with this reaching out children in neighborhoods has played a big part in helping curb the violence in our community. Me coming from the streets gave me a good idea of what I needed to attack. One of the number one things is, and I've always said this, and I think this is how the first big program in Pulaski County, which is the county that we're in, was started, was when a state judge came and asked me way back when I was banging, LaFell, what could we do to get these kids off the streets? And I told her, you know, find a place for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
They created
yep.
a program called the Hour Clubs way back then, which gave the kids an opportunity to get off the streets from
yep.
the hours of 2 to 6, which is, we know nationally, is the time when most youth get in trouble.
Yep.
I myself went to federal prison for drug trafficking, and I did my time. While I was in prison, there was something, an underlying problem that I found that a lot of our youth are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school, graduated, got my GED, couldn't read or write.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
Wow.
And as I was in federal prison, and all of the young men and women would, you know, the young men would come up to me and say, what's going on, OG? You know, and I would have them assign a thing, and they would wake up the next morning in school. Of
wow.
course, for me doing this now, I was sent to five different federal prisons because they said I was a shot caller. But I knew then that, you know, the lack of education played a big part in how many people was going to end up in prison the next year.
Yep.
So I kind of planned when I came home that I was going to make a difference. And I planned this in prison, which you hear a lot of people talk about, but nobody really acts on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget a young man, a young brother named Al, who I can mention his name because he's doing the same work. he and I was sitting in a cell one night in federal prison in FCI Memphis. And I told him, I said, man, when I go home, I'm going to try to make sure that not one more young man from our neighborhood comes to this prison or are killed. And he said, man, they follow you when you're shooting, but I don't think no one's going to follow you.
Wow.
Well,
mm-hmm.
you know, needless to say, in a short story, as I went and did my time, this kid went on to go to a state prison because he had life for murder. And I never forget when I went to visit him in state prison after I got out, he said he started a program called Unity. And he said it was inspired by him, by me, because he looked at a newspaper one day, and lo and behold, there was LaFell Jackson doing what he said he was going to do from a prison cell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really touched me because it let me know that, at our worst, when we think we have no more, nothing else to offer, we have everything. And sometimes we just have to walk the walk. And I got out and and came home and worked at the Hour Club, the same program that was started by this judge back in 92 when the murder rate in Arkansas was higher than it was in California and New York per capita.
Mm.
And I started working for them. Well, after a couple of years, they pulled the funding. And I at that point, I'm very loyal. I've always been and committed. I wasn't about to turn my face on the kids, so I started the program Rockin', which in turn, our number one thing is, we play a big part in education, but the number one thing, and I heard that brother say, is providing a safe place
yep.
for the kids to come after school.
Yep.
Wow.
Now, I tell you, at the end of the day, it may not seem like much, but those kids have to go in these projects or in these communities, and they have to turn this knob on. This knob that they turn on will define whether they're going to be hard
mm-hmm.
or whether they're going to be normal. And sometimes, when they go back, when they go out of the neighborhood and go and do functions, they turn it off and be kids again.
Right.
But when they go back in the neighborhood, in order to survive,
yep.
they have to turn it back on. and they get it mixed up sometime, and that's how you see them. You'll see one kid, yeah, and you'll be like, this kid is not like this. I'll talk to this kid. He's not mean. Well, you know, I provide that place for those kids to be kids, first of all,
mm-hmm,
because I'm a believer that you can't learn nothing if your behavior and your attitude is gone. If you won't listen, there's no way for the best,
right,
teacher in the world to teach you.
Yep.
Well, let me ask you all, how are these programs funded? Sally Hazelgrove, how do you fund your organization?
Well, you know, I kind of had to make a decision and decide that I was either going to chase money or I was just going to do this. And I'm a deeply spiritual person, so I decided to step out on faith and kind of, you know, see what it's like to live poor, for one thing, without meaning to. And I live in Inglewood, and I've just kind of been amazed at God, because although I currently have no funding, you know, God has shown me that with desire and a good heart, and that you can do something. And I've been able to put together this program and these boys and see, you know, just really what was needed and what made a difference. And my dream is to actually have that youth center that you're talking about, because I agree 100%. We need a safe haven in Inglewood. I've been working out there 10 years, and these kids still don't have a safe place to go. So I'm working on getting some funding. To be honest with you, I feel like if I do God's work, God will take care of the funding for me as long as I keep the running in my feet.
Okay, so Restoring the Path currently needs a building.
Oh, yeah, we need a huge building. I mean, my dream is to have a youth center that has more. I have such a huge demand for the boxing, and we go to different gyms. My van got stolen when I first moved to Inglewood because I think they thought it was the police. And
tell them, how many white people are in Inglewood?
I've been told I'm the only white female living in Inglewood. But so it's kind of funny. And I figure God had my van leave because I have to walk everywhere in Inglewood, and it kind of makes them get used to me. It was kind of humorous. I've got a lot of funny stories, because the first time I went to go get ice before I had a refrigerator, five people tried to sell me drugs. Five people thought I was a prostitute, and five people thought I was the police. But that aside, you know, there's many people, many of the, actually the gang members that you would call them and stuff, you know, I've always had nothing but love for them because, like I said, I view all of them as what if this was my son, because I have a son. And, but back to the funding, I'm starting the process of writing some grants. And like the man who said his vision to raise $20 million and not depend on the government, I'm with him on that. I have a vision of raising $20 million and making United States citizens stop labeling them as gangbangers and see them as children. Because as we all know, the majority are like 11 to 17 because of the high rate of death and incarceration. And I'm like, these are kids. And the majority of United States citizens who are distanced from this out of fear see them as ruthless criminals, which we know they're not. They have hearts. They have souls. They have dreams. They have lived more life than a lot of adults have. You know, and they're strong, and I think they're just leaders inside every one of them, and that's what I tell every one of them is, I see greatness in you.
Wow.
You know, my job is to pull that greatness out, but I love you and I'm proud of you, because I feel like kids need to hear that more. Even the kids, everybody say, oh, he's bad. I'm like, well, those are the ones I love, because I was once that bad child, and
right,
by the grace of God, I've never gone to prison or nothing like that. I also grew up in an upper-class, white, middle-class neighborhood, you know, so my consequences weren't like their consequences when I was a kid. Because it is not a level playing field. We all know that.
I agree. Robert Lewis, how is Street Safe Boston funded, and how did you raise all this money?
It might sound crazy. I mean, as I'm listening to everyone, you know, it's simple to look when you say, if you look at the Boston Foundation, I'm vice president. I oversee the $20 million grant making from the city. And, and I'm here because brothers like the Selling folks took a young brother from the projects, grew up in the hood, running around, and actually kicked my butt and made sure I did the right thing. I'm going to tell you just, for me, it's simple. First of all, it is, I think, sometimes in all of us in this field, we're also humble and kind.
Mm-hmm.
How dare we allow other organizations who say they work with these kids and they don't?
Oh, I know.
See, the issue is we have places, we have spaces, but organizations don't want to serve this population.
No, they don't.
And people are funding them because people are saying they do. So at the foundation, see, I know in Boston, people use the word like at risk and stuff. A lot of our kids live in at risk situations, but not all of our kids are at risk. If we educate them, we feed them, we keep them healthy. What we made the decision to do is we're looking at organizations who say they're doing it. I assess it. We know they don't. We don't fund them, period. The second thing was, and here's something I'll just share with folks, and again, and I had to learn this myself. If I make this an issue just around young black and brown skin kids dying, America doesn't have to care because this has been a 100-year, 300-year story. What people need to understand is that if we don't, and I use this, and I'm saying in all sincerity, there's a report that came out that said in the next 15 years, America will be short of labor jobs for the 21st century. We will not have enough competent, qualified folks for the jobs that we're going to need in the next 15 years. And you know why we're going to have a shortage? It has nothing to do with the number of white kids that are going to college and educated. It's because it's these black and brown skin kids who are dying, who are incarcerated, but who aren't employed and unskilled.
Yep.
So the business community has to understand if they want a workforce that's going to keep generating resources and money and income for them, they have to invest now.
Yep.
So I make this around, yes, violence, but this is also going to be about labor, workforce, and others. And if you believe this or not, every major corporate leader in Boston, I bring them out, that's why I say foster around the neighborhood, to meet these young brothers and sisters just to meet them. And as my sister was just saying, Sally, they are smart, they're talented, they're resourceful. The thing I need is just an opportunity. And I'm not going to lie to you. Some of these dudes we work with, some of them need to get locked up for a little while to get themselves to come back out. But the high majority of these young folks are just looking for a crack in the door. And we all know if it's not education and if it's not a job, we're going to be talking about this in 50 years. So we've been fortunate enough that I've gotten two major CEOs in Boston to step up and take this on and who have actually pledged $1 million. The Boston Foundation has given $5 million to them. It is the biggest gift we have given to anything in close to 100-year history of this organization. And I'm also smart enough to know it's the people we hire, the partnerships we have. And I go and I talk to these young folks around if we want a chance and an opportunity for change, they have to be committed too. Because this isn't about us just opening up buildings, getting jobs and all this. The young folks have to make a decision to put the guns down.
Wow.
They got to put the guns down. They don't put the guns down, I can't get them a job. I can't get them their education. They have to make a commitment to put a gun down. And if they do that, then I get business and others that are willing to invest. So it is a partnership, and I can tell you, we all know this because, man, a lot of us ain't too different from these young brothers. As long as they know there's a hope and an opportunity, they'll change. But I've just been frustrated that too many organizations say they're working with this population, and they're being funded, and they're not.
LaFell Jackson.
That would also have to change.
LaFell Jackson, how is Rokan funded?
Well, it's amazing. I'm kind of feeling like Sally here. I'm not funded at all, basically. I was funding Rokan by my public speaking as I go around the country to help educate young men and women about gang violence and drugs and the impact that it had on my community and the same thing that it would have on theirs if they continue to participate in it. I was taking the money that I was making, and that's how I was running it. Well, here recently we've had a big, you know, everybody lost money. So there was no public speaking coming in. So we're right now at zero when you talk about funding. Arkansas, can I say, is probably one of the most unforgiving states in the whole country. You get a felony here, you're labeled for life. And unfortunately, me at a young age had a felony, and then I went on and went to federal prison. So it's really hard for me to interact with the people that is supposed to help. I'm utilized now when they have programs to do things. Oh, let's call the fail. When it comes to helping get funding for our youth and again the community that I work in, nobody steps up versus a few. Now, we do have some people that step up, and I just can't say nobody, but Steve Nowoyczyk, you mentioned him earlier. He's one of my biggest supporters when it comes to getting people to come out and see what we're doing. And I remember at one time I had a bounty out on him. I thought he was a police officer also. And I had a $10,000 bounty out on him. And I found out later that he wasn't. And I'm glad that that didn't happen, because that would have been one good person that I would have lost in my life as we went on. So we don't get funding from anyone right now. We're in a city-owned building that the city has kind of backed up. They're not providing any type of help as far as keeping it up. Now, City Year, which is a President Clinton-owned youth program, came over the other week, and they helped us revitalize the building. But we think about our youth, and, of course, we can sometimes get money for the youth, but it's the people that work with the youth. And I feel that if a person hadn't had the experience of being in the street, most of the gang members, every one of them that I've seen, you know, now say, man, I want to get out of this. I want a job.
Of course they do.
That's right. That's right.
I feel bad because I can't offer them one.
Wow.
So that's awful for me to be the leader of a leader of a program that's supposed to help these young men and women leave this life behind, and I'm at zero myself.
Wow. Melvin Carter, how is the Boys and Girls Club funded?
Well, in the early 90s, that was a major gang issue here in the Fort Worth area. I do work with the Boys and Girls Club. I am part of the Boys and Girls Club, but the agreement with the city of Fort Worth came the Coming Up program, and I'm actually the project director of the Coming Up Gang Intervention Program that has now been operating since 1994. Our money comes strictly from we're actually a line item in the city's budget, which is phenomenal. I mean, it's very, very a very giving city that understood from the police all the way down that we can't solve this problem locking people up. It was just a revolving door. I mean, we've got to do something to intervene in these kids' life at an early age. I do agree with the brother. He's talking about people who are doing this work. And I think that when the RFPs go out or the grant money is available, I think a lot of times people look at that RFP and say prevention, it's prevention work or intervention work. We have to start to definitely make people understand that, you know, prevention is prevention. When you get money to prevent a problem or to prevent kids from doing something, bottom line is you're preventing them from joining the gang. Once they already join the gang, you're in strictly intervention mode. That's a different beast now. That's a different animal that you have to deal with. And so it's not the same. So your program may be, you may have a few kids who you may suspect that's a gang member that's coming to your program, and you're getting X amount of dollars for it, but you're not really doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
We make sure that through our program, that bottom line is you have to be a gang member. Matter of fact, we even hire a gang member inside our program to make it more authentic and to bring those gang members in that really need the help. So we have a very loving city. I go across the country and speak at a lot of places, and when I say that I'm a line item in the city's budget, people look at me like, and at that line item right now is at $2.2 million. That's very generous from a city to reach out to a nonprofit and say, you know what, we want to help. We know that we can't solve this problem. We know that we can't use our police and suppression. Everybody knows that works in this business knows that there's four parts to this thing. It's prevention, intervention, reintegration, and suppression. You got to have those four parts in any city to make it a great city. And I thank Fort Worth for stepping up to the plate and understanding that.
Wow. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD's 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, part two of gang violence. Are your colors worth dying for. If you're on the phone line and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-2390. And again, press 1. A reminder, Mr. A.J. Houston has joined us and is a man in the chat room today. So if you're in the chat room, post up your questions or comments, and Mr. A.J. Houston will present them to the panel. I'd like to go to Robert Lewis Jr. because I know, Mr. Lewis, you're going to only be with us for the first hour. Can you tell us any success stories that have come out of your organization's work?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, one, when we start thinking about in Massachusetts, we have our criminal offender records check, and we've been working on a lot of legislation over the years in terms of getting folks who have records hired. One of the things I said is about 80% of our staff that we have are folks who have records. And, I mean, from a foundation perspective, and if you know the foundation we heard throughout this country, that is shocking to even have folks with a query. What we have been able to see in just this year and a half, we've been able to place over 32 young folks into jobs. And again, if anyone looks up StreetSafe, you know, the difference with our program, we are working with the 1%. You know, every single one of our folks have been identified by the police and a gang unit or so on is one of the shooters in the city. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking with folks if it's a gang of 20, those that might be 5 to 20. We're talking about the number 1, 2, or 3. We have seen a high number of our folks go back to school and get a GED. One of the biggest issues because of their criminal offender and their records, it's hard for them to get funding, if any federal funding, if they want to go on to college or a community college, which, again, is frustrating because for a young person who's trying to change their lives. And, again, I think the biggest thing that we have seen in our city so far is, again, the gangs that have been identified as the top-tier gangs in the city. There has been, just in the first year, a 20% reduction in shootings and murders. So we can't take the, you know, all the credit for that, no way. But we are able to do comparable data over the years to say, you know, over the last 10 years, this has been what it's been. Since StreetSafe has been up and running, we have seen a 20% decrease. We have seen more kids getting jobs, more kids getting resources. And as everyone said about space, we know the traditional hours, again, of nonprofits as they close. Our safe house, which we have, that we offer GED, ESL, culinary, and others, is open until about 4 in the morning. Mm. So we keep our facility open for when the kids need it. We have it staffed up. We have it resourced up. And we want to make sure that the young folks know they have a safe place to go. So that's, you know, that's what we're doing now. We still have an additional $8 to $9 million we have to raise. But we're seeing some results. But what we're going to continue to do is to look at programs like, you know, those that are on this phone call today. We want to keep learning what the best practices are. And if there is one thing I do think, and I go back to, again, starting the program in Boston in 1990, there is no national database or conference that brings the practitioners, all of the workers that do the work on the street together, for them to share best practices and models.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like this, and again, I feel honored to be on the call. I'm the guy who starts it. I'm the guy who raises the money. I'm the guy who's leading it. But the people who do the work all the time, the practitioners, don't know each other throughout the country. And I think we have to bring them together because I think we can learn a lot from the folks that are doing the work right on the street every single day with the young folks. And we pay researchers millions of dollars to do the research, but the workers on the street only make $25,000 to $30,000, if that. So we have to do that, and that's why we actually believe we'll be successful because we have to invest in the street workers and those folks who are the former gang leaders who are out there making sure that positive change is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my conversation with your communications director, Mr. Trueblood, this week, he stated that you all were interested in doing this program in other parts of the country. Is that the case?
I'll tell you honestly, when we started this, it's been interesting for us, and you know, he might have told you Harvard University just named this one of the best practices. We've Attorney General Eric Holder had us come to D.C. to present this. we didn't start this, honestly, to be a new national model. We started this to reduce violence and crime in Boston. What we have done is for those that have seen all of what we do, a piece of what we do, and if any of this can be of value, that's fine. If there is one thing I think we will offer this whole network is this whole idea of how did we do this thing on private funding? This is one of the things everyone I talk to throughout the country, you know, I think is like just shocked that we have raised private money and we have no government money at all in this initiative so far. So, you know, we're willing to talk to folks. We're willing to work with folks. But again, we if it becomes something that other cities are interested in, great. But it's not it wasn't our intent to say this should be a national model. But if it helps reduce violence and has a direct impact around the country, so be it. As I said, as we want to continue to learn from everyone else that's doing great work.
Wow. LaFell Jackson, any success stories out of Rokan?
Well, you know, when I think about the success stories, I think about I'll go back to the funding part. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember one day here last year I was sitting on the steps because we had just ran completely out of money. And two cars pulled up. And when the two cars pulled up, it was two of my bigger kids. And, well, actually, it was three of them. And they got out of the car. And they came up and they said, Mr. LaFell, are you okay? And I said, yes, I'm all right. I'm just sitting out in front of the center. And they handed me an envelope. And as I opened the envelope up, it said, just because of you, I will be walking across the stage to get my diploma.
Wow.
And I was, you know, and it was a invitation to come to their graduation. To me, that was paid for everything that I have ever done with our youth. We have one of our directors who came to me 8 years ago, Ms. Smith, and she had four boys and a girl. And she said, Mr. LaFell, I have no idea what to do with these boys. I don't know what to do. Well, now one of the boys is in the Air Force. The daughter went on to graduate, and she's going into early childhood care. The two of the boys are going to graduate from high school here. And the mom went back to college, and she's now our director of operations at Rokan. So those are success stories within themselves to show, you know, that, you know, just at a little pace, we're making big difference in our community. Not to mention that our crime rate around the area where our program went down 45% within the first year of the program. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Wow, that is. That's a wonderful story. Ms. Hazelgrove, anything stories out of your program?
You know, there's so many young men and some very many young women I'm so proud of the way they've changed their lives, but I guess some of the ones that stick out is a young man named Paris who I was in a school and I said, you know, who are the boys you most scared of or you think are most dangerous? I want them. And Paris was this boy and they were like, oh, no, he's too dangerous. Even his mother. She's like, oh, no, Paris dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. But they agreed to let me work with him. And he's been with me for 2.5 years and he's in high school now. He does great at school. He doesn't get in any more fights. All he does is box and stay in the house. He was getting horrible grades before. He had a learning disability. He's raised his learning level significantly, and he is not labeled at the school as he was at his old school as a child to watch out for, a problem child. And he respects it. I mean, I have a lot of parents that call me and be like, let me tell you about your boy today. And I always say, put him on the phone. And try to correct their behavior and about respecting their parents, et cetera, or if they went out when they're not supposed to. And so, you know, I have many young men that came to me labeled as the bad kids at their school who are now doing very well at school and more respectful at home. And we've competed in over 30 fights in the past 2 years. And I have many boys who proudly display their trophies all over their dressers. And I think to me the biggest success is when they learn to show empathy to others. I always tell them, I want you to be like me. I want you to do what I do. I want you to show love more. Regardless of what people say or think. I'm like, I want you to look at somebody younger. I want you to show him some love. Tell him why he should behave. You know, boxing is my carrot. Once I hook them with it, then I start demanding things on their behavior at school. And I go into the schools and ask, how's he doing, et cetera, you know. And if they fight in school and outside of boxing, then there'll be some type of consequence. But I never kick a kid out of the program permanently. They might get suspended for a week, or they just can't participate in the fights because we have about 15 fights a year. But so, you know, I guess that kind of showed me God can work without the money. But like everybody else, you know, I need the funding, and I wanted to say to the young man, Phil Jackson, you know, my vision, and I think, you know, you should share this. This might help you as well, is I feel like if I could get every citizen that resides in Illinois to send $10 in, you know, that would be over $20 million. And my whole thing is total transparency. I want to put my budget on the Internet because I want people to see exactly where the money goes. And nobody gets to get rich off this. If I can live off of a very low salary, so can anybody else, you know, to attract the right people to mimic what we do. And that safe house, I mean, that just really hit my heart big when I heard about what you've done in Boston. And I thought, you know, we need one of those desperately in Inglewood and in the surrounding communities, because a lack of a place to go, and especially for those kids that, even though there might be a youth center here or there, a lot of them have barriers to this demographic.
Right.
And they'll say, well, I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, you could have your boxing program in my big, huge place, but I don't want any bad kids. You know, and I'm just like, well, I'm not even going to waste time walking through that door, because I only target kids that I don't call bad but just have some behavioral problems. And, you know, and we break out in fights sometimes amongst ourselves.
Wow.
And but you move forward. Do you know what I mean? It's actually, it's kind of funny in a way. It's become humorous for us, because now all the boys that have been in it for a while, they'll be the ones breaking it up. You know, and they'll be like, no, we're going to take it in the ring. But finding that space, you know, and I know God's going to deliver it. I do want to share some good news I received. There's a boxing gym shutting down, and they saw my website, and they're going to be donating. And I've asked them for 30 to 60 days for me to find a spot, but they're going to donate about $25,000 to $30,000 worth of boxing equipment.
Wow.
And a ring and everything. And I was just so happy, and I called all the boys, you know, and they're jumping up and down. They're like, we're going to get our gym. And that's the other thing. It is their gym. I always tell them, you are restoring the past, whether or not you realize it. You are what this is all about, not me. You're going to restore each other's paths. You're going to take over one day from me. I'm like, you know, and that's kind of my vision, though. And I would say to Phil Jackson, ask those in your city, in your state, whatever, just send me $10 each. Because if you can get 2 million of them just to send you $10 each, that's $20 million to work with.
Very true. Melvin Carter, any success stories out of the Boys and Girls Club?
Oh, that's plenty. That's a lot of success stories. 20% of our population, we call it a life change, receive what we call a life change. And that can be anywhere from staying on a job for 90 days or going through returning back to school, getting their GED, going to the armed forces or joining Job Corps. But we put a special little piece together because our kids spoke directly to us one and told us, you want us to stop selling drugs, you want us to, you know, you want us to be better citizens, and create an opportunity, not just a job, we want a career. So we put another piece together called Career Launch, where we actually start now to produce with the local, the help of the local universities, culinary arts, mechanics. We've got kids going through CNA. We've got a bunch of other things that we've attached, that carrot that we talked about earlier, where kids now feel good about themselves, and now the kids are coming back and speaking to those kids who are gang members and saying, you know what, hey man, this is the direction, this is the path. You can make this amount of money, and you can take care of your kids by doing this. So, you know, it's and like the young lady said, you know, it's restoring your path, and I really like that. You're definitely building your own communities back. We have to understand first and foremost that we need to take back our communities, not in a radical way with guns and knives, but we need to take it back mentally. We need to go back into our communities and make our kids feel special, feel like they're a part of something. When I drive down some of the neighborhoods that I go in, there's some senseless things I see, like billboards with Crown Royal, up on the billboard, or they're advertising some cigarette, or they, you know, this is in our neighborhoods, but I don't see that across, you know, across town. You don't see those type of advertisements. Also, I challenge, I would say this, and I commend everybody on the panel, and you guys that are not getting funding, God bless you, man. I wish it was something that I could do to help you. But as far as this work is concerned, this is serious work.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that people are doing it with their heart and their souls, but people should be compensated for what they do. And these individuals that are part of this solution to this major problem should be compensated for the work that they're doing. We can pay a man $1 million to dunk a basketball, but we can't pay a teacher, or we can't pay a worker like ourselves who's out there in the street. Mm-hmm. We can't pay them. We have to justify why we should get paid or why we should make a living. You know, we're doing God's work. This is God's work. But we also have to survive.
Absolutely. Let me ask, when you hear people, and I think Melvin Carter was probably the only one that remembers this conversation, from our last show that we talked about gang violence, two of the callers were very disturbing. One said that he would shoot a 10-year-old if he were confronted in a situation, and another felt that these troubled teens were locked away. What do you say to adults when they speak about the children that you're helping in that manner? LaFell Jackson.
Well, one thing I've always said now, and to be honest with you, is that I would rather face a hardened gang member with a gun than a young kid who has no experience. Two things there. One is the hardened gang member, he already know the consequences of pulling the trigger, where our young kids don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, at some point, faced with a young man standing in front of you with a gun, and you have the option of, what you should do. First of all, now, you do have to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And go back to just what the guy says. There's some kids that's not just, gang members, that they're not going to get it. Some kids are going to get locked up, and they probably need to be locked up because they won't ever get it. We don't know who those kids are, so we have to be mindful in giving choices and chances to the ones that do. And I got to tell you this real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
About 20 years ago, I was riding in a car with a young man who's now a state senator, and he asked me, "Leader, where you see yourself at in 6 months?" Well, at that point, I was a gang leader and a major drug dealer, and I told him I seen myself dead are in prison for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our kids, their whole outlook is bleak.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see past a month, 2 days, or even an hour. So and when we approach them, we have to be mindful of that or when they approach us.
Wow. See, Melvin Carter, you remember the conversation, don't you?
Definitely.
Yeah, and so what did you think of that caller in the way he addressed? I mean, it was two callers. One, I believe, said if a 10-year-old came up on a bicycle and he had a gun, he would not hesitate to shoot. And the other one felt like he did not want these kinds of kids around his children, if I remember correctly.
Well,
what do you say to people who think like that and don't believe that they should be a part of the solution?
Well, I make them think about their own personal families. There may be, everybody has issues. Everybody has problems. I don't care who you are. If you look deep down into your family, you'll find somebody who
mm-hmm.
is a troubled individual. And you may want to write that person off, and but more importantly, that you have a personal relationship with that person, and you pretty much know that person has some good in them. The caller they called, I really became real quiet because it was very disturbing to know that there's individuals out there that would say that a 10-year-old, I would shoot a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that I wouldn't have to shoot a 50-year-old, you know. You know, I don't want to shoot anyone, but he was very adamant about what he was doing. And the other caller was very adamant about locking kids up, you know, like we haven't done that before, you know. That's not the solution, and that's not the solution to our problem. But to go even further, I just think they were crazy, to be honest with you. And if they're listening to me, I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, you may think I'm crazy too, but we as a society have to realize that, you know, we've got to do things differently. We've got to do things decently and in order. And one of the things that we have to do is to first reach out to our youth. There's a disconnection between our generation and the young people. We've always wanted a generation like the generation that's coming up. They're not afraid of anything, but mm-hmm. we're not directing them. We're not mm-hmm. directing them. We're not putting them in the right directions. We're not saying to them, we're not having that conversation with them. You know, I think one of the rappers, might have been Snoop, said, if you want me to say something, you know, good about on the radio, or if you want me to rap about something that's good, then create a good place for me to live. And I'll mm-hmm. talk about that. You know,
mm-hmm.
so bottom line is we've got to give them, you know, a place where they can feel special. And we've got to go back as adults. And I remember just sitting down and having those long conversations with elders in the community when I was younger, telling me how, you know, life used to be and how the history and where I come from and who I am and how special I am. We've got to go back and be able to relate that same story to our kids and make them better people.
I agree. Sally, you reach out to those, I guess they would call troubled teens.
Mm-hmm.
Say it, what would you say to those callers that felt the way that they did about the kids that you reach out to?
I would say first and foremost, what if that was your child? Mm-hmm. Don't think, everybody thinks they're so removed from things that it couldn't be them. But I know they're acting out of fear, and I see a lot of that. I see a lot of fear between the races. And I would say to them that, you know, all children are God's children, even the murderers. And I guess as you and I talked before on the phone, I feel that one of the things coming out of all my work is the need to get to the America, the what we would quote-unquote say like a normal U.S. citizen living in middle-class America, pretty much removed from this except what they see on the media, et cetera, and get them to care about these youth like we do, to see them as children, as youth, and not as these hardened criminals to be feared and to be locked away or killed and, you know, and good if they kill each other. And I guess I would just say, you know, somebody should pray for that, man, because those that put out hate like that and everything, you know, we all have to account for what we do in this world.
Definitely.
So.
Great. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD's 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, part two of gang violence. Are your colors worth dying for? If you're on the phone line and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And again, press 1. A reminder, Mr. A.J. Houston is manning the chat room tonight. So if you're listening via the Internet, post your questions and comments up in chat, and Mr. A.J. Houston will present them to the panel. In research for this show, I discovered that there were over 30,000 gangs with over 800,000 members impacting some 2,500 communities across the U.S. And according to the Department of Justice survey, 20% of all students aged 12 through 18 reported that street gangs were present in their schools during the last 6 months. That said, Mr. Joe Bull Plummer out there, who's just, you know, average person, today, what could they be doing if they can't do the work that you all are doing, let's just say?
Mm-hmm.
What could they do to be a part of the solution? Anybody?
They could go ahead and find the program that's hands-on, that where the money's going, it's supposed to go, and send them $10 or $20. You know, if they can't donate, I've always said, and I don't expect people to be like me, but if you can't donate an hour of your time, then donate even just a little bit of your money to a worthwhile cause that's working with this demographic that you know this money is going to go where it's supposed to and not in somebody's pocket.
Wow. LaFell Jackson.
Yes.
What should Joe Blow Plumber do to be part of the solution and not part of the problem?
Well, I agree. Here recently, we did a scene on my Facebook that every one of my Facebook friends could just send a dollar. I think I have 750 Facebook friends. $1 adds up to $750 a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's sent every month, it's not, you know, it's a small amount that you would probably not miss. You know, sometimes we just have to step outside of our box and,
yep.
and just give a little. You know, I know it's a little different with me. I'm a convicted felon, and when people talk about giving to my program, there's, you know, it's a big thing. Okay, well, you know, this guy's a convicted felon. Don't look at me. You look at the youth and around in our communities and the impact that our center has had on them and give to help him better our city, our state, and our country.
Mm-hmm.
Melvin Carter, what can they do?
Oh, that all those above. I mean, yeah, we all did, all programs need funding, but also they can start to go into their neighborhoods and again finding individuals. You know, stop being afraid of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I see a lot of that. That you know, a lot of our so-called leaders are afraid to go back to the neighborhoods that they grew up in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ironic to me is, you know, one thing I know that I can always go back home. If the bottom drop out, I can go home because if you sow good seeds, you know, you can go back.
Yeah.
A lot of the individuals that I know are from the business world can go in and mentor a child, speak with an individual, and they put that money where their mouth is. You know, go back and help redesign that neighborhood. Give them opportunities. If you have a company or you're an entrepreneur, give a brother a chance that you know may have a felony. Just you know, step out on faith. That's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, he may be the one that can help you turn not only your company around, but he might be the one that can help you turn the whole community around. So. Just stop looking with tunnel vision when you look at people or you look at kids. First and foremost, we need to understand, and everybody needs to understand that they're human beings first before they're games.
Absolutely.
You know, they were human beings, and they may be a little dysfunctional. I come from a dysfunctional family, and
we all
does it.
I'm pretty sure my family might not want to hear that, but yeah, we're a little dysfunctional. You know, but the point of the matter is that we love one another. And some of these, when we say gang members, one of the things I say about these young brothers and sisters, they love each other. And
mm-hmm.
they're willing to do whatever it is to get that point across as far as whatever they're going after at that moment. You know, but we as individuals have to reach back and go into those neighborhoods and give them opportunities to become responsible citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to go to the phone lines. Your phone number is not showing up, but Dr. Fakuk, I think I'm pronouncing
Hello.
You correctly. Good afternoon. Welcome to Center Stage.
Hi. I think what we need to do is we need to just round up all these gangsters and then send them back to the fields to pick cotton.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry.
Don't talk radio.
I think they call those haters. But anyway, that's the first one of those on Center Stage. LaFell Jackson, for somebody to say something like that, what do you think?
Hello?
LaFell Jackson.
What do I think about him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I think that this guy is probably a person who's been scorned in life and probably need to seek some mental health treatment, because I think for someone just to even come on there and say that, he reminds me of an old slave driver who's back in the days when we had slaves who say that we should pick cotton, and he's probably either two things. One, he's being supported by the kids that's having these issues and going to prison. That's how he supports himself. He's just a racist.
Sally Hazelgrove, how do you address a caller like that?
I would really don't have much to say except, you know, shame on you. And just shame on you, you know, that you are so unintelligent to judge people by where they come from or the color of their skin. So such a lack of intelligence and a lack of foresight. And that, you know, you're going to have to answer for that. You're God's child, too. And if you think God's proud of you right now, he's not. Shame on you. These are children we're talking about. And you might be careful about what you say, because it could be your child that happens to then, and that somebody treats with that type of racist mentality.
Ooh.
That's all I have to say.
Melvin Carter.
I won't even address that. That's the ignorance, man. That's the stigma. I mean, as a matter of fact, I really believe Carter just called to get a reaction. He didn't call with anything other than the fact that he wanted us to react to him. I'm not going to react to that garbage, you know.
And I will not either. Moving on. You know, I remember when crack first came on the scene. Someone told me the other day, they said, you know, when crack first came on the scene and AIDS first came on the scene, everybody thought that was somebody else's problem. Remember? And then all of a sudden, crack started affecting your family, and then all of a sudden you knew someone who had contracted AIDS. Are we going to see the same thing happening with gang violence if we don't do something, meaning everybody get involved, that eventually we'll see gang violence affect us in one way or another?
Absolutely. And, you know, there already are. I mean, everybody acts like African Americans are the only gang members. There's huge numbers in the Chinese gangs, in the Latino gangs, you know, in white gangs. I mean, it's just ridiculous that it gets a racist bent like that, and that people like that, you know, they come out and just want to categorize a whole race. It's just ridiculous.
Wow. You remember Mr. LaFell, that, you know, remember crack was all of a sudden somebody else's problem, and then AIDS was somebody else's problem, and then it knocked on, you know, somebody that you knew door. Don't you think the same will happen
Yes, I do. Yes, I did. But I can tell you right now, as I go across the country to talk to young kids, you know, young white males and females is the number one target for gang violence right now. It's an already infiltrated and went through our communities like crack.
Mm-hmm.
Crack is probably now more used by young white males and females because it had already attacked our communities, and we've went through it, you know, once again. I think that at the end of the day, though, we as a collective body has to address these issues. And young men like the guy that came on with coming together. Now, I notice, you know, he has the right. That's the good thing about this country, though. We all have a right to say and to speak our mind, freedom of speech.
Yep.
So that's how he feels. But if he have any kids, I'll tell you, I'm dealing with more young men and women that's not supposed to be here. What I'm going to say, I guess, young white males police officers that's calling me saying, hey, I want you to talk to my kid because he won't listen to me right now and he's getting involved in gangs. You better watch out, because what, like the young lady say, you know, what you say, watch what you say.
Yep.
This is very true. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, part two of gang violence. Are your colors worth dying for? If you're on the phone line and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And again, press 1. A reminder, Mr. A.J. Houston is manning the chat room tonight. So if you're listening via the Internet, post up your questions and comments in chat, and Mr. A.J. Houston will present them to the panel. LaFell Jackson, seeing that caller called in, brings me here. You were an ex-leader of a gang of Crips. What that person doesn't know is that there's people like the person that you used to be that was just sitting out there ready to recruit his child. So
you know, and the other part, you know, that they may convince you to think that when you talk about recruiting, you think of a man coming, gang members coming in your hood with guns and recruiting your kids. With that's not how it goes.
Mm-mm.
Okay, we would go in the neighborhood and nice cars, and we would pick the kids that we know that would be loyal, the kids that didn't have. And I never forget one time I gave a kid $100 bill and say, go to the store, get me a Coke. And he ran down to the store. He didn't have no shoes on. And when he come back, he said, they can't change this here, but Mr. Wilson gave you this Coke. Well, in one day, I learned more about that city, about that little town, than the people who had been staying there for 30 years. So in the midst of that, thinking that maybe he's pulled up, he's somewhere up in a little town somewhere where there's only just the people he know, and the gangs won't be there, violence has no boundaries. For violence, you know, and if we don't stop right now and act as we're doing today, he may wake up one night thinking he's safe, and someone may be staring at him right in his face.
As a leader, I think I asked you in the pre-interview. I said, Mr. Jackson, how is it that you, as a gang member? Well, I think I was trying to tread lightly on asking the question. I said, didn't you have to be somewhat manipulative in order to do what you do, or you do what you did, being a gang leader? Tell them what you told me, LaFell.
Manipulative. Yeah, well, in some forms,
okay,
you do have, you know, to be manipulative.
Okay.
But what you have to do is kind of be real.
Okay.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
I only took the things that I learned on the streets and applied them to the same thing that I was doing to lead kids away from gangs and to become citizens of our community. You know? So, of course, I'm very manipulative. But kids see through that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're trying to trick someone, one of these kids, they see right through you.
Wow.
And help me out, Carrie, if I said something else. Help me to go back to that moment.
No, I think that's what's really my suggestion. Well, you,
okay.
Because I was trying to understand, how does someone stay on top? Because anybody knows, once you get to the top, then the problem becomes staying on the top. So I was trying to understand, how do you manipulate the people underneath you and then still be one step ahead of the other gangs out there? And so,
well,
I think,
yeah,
it's just pretty much...
I tell you what, I thought that I was going to have some issues. My first problem when I came home from prison was to convince my kids. All of my kids were gang members. Every
and
one of them,
family.
All of my daughters. And me and sons were gang members, my brothers. And to come home and walk the walk and show them that, you know, you can do different. I had to come home and do that. Now, let me tell you, I don't have to be as manipulative as I was, because all I have to do is stay straight on the straight and narrow and do what I do. And kids will follow you.
Mm-hmm.
I have more people following me today to do the right thing than I ever had followed
mm-hmm.
me to do the wrong thing.
Wow, that's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Sally Hazelgrove, how do you get kids to buy into going with you to go boxing as opposed to wanting to get involved in gangs? How do you make
you
that?
Know, it's really, it's, I'd love to sit here and act like it's taken me some big effort, but it's really, somebody once asked me, he said, how do you have this incredible rapport with this demographic of boys that are, you know, acting out or would be labeled gang bangers and et cetera? And I said, you know, it's a Christ thing. They see Christ, they get past the fact that I'm Caucasian, and then they see love in my eyes for them as if they're my child, and they kind of, it mirrors back to me. And I just break through any of that and just immediately, I'm very much quick to the point and very much, like you said, keep it real. And I'll just be like, want to go box? And when I was first in Inglewood, I was walking down the street one day and a bunch of kids were on the other side and they were picking up rocks to throw at me. So I decided to walk across the street and walk right up to them. And I'm like, you know, we're all like cars. I'm like, we come in different shapes and models and views, but our driver is the heart. I'm like, I'm a car that loves other cars. I love kids. I'm like, so y'all can either try to throw those rocks at me or you can drop them and go to the park with me. Well, they all drop their rocks and follow me to the park.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just have so many youth coming at me, actually. You know, Miss Sally, Miss Sally. And, of course, I've become pretty well known. But I don't even have to approach them. They approach me now. I get phone calls from young men in their 17, 18, 19, 20 saying, Miss Sally, I want to come box with you. And, you know, like I said, boxing has always been really, I'm about saving and changing lives, as many as I can, but boxing is the vehicle God gave me to do it with. And that gets me their attention. And then once I have their trust and attention, which is pretty quick, we start to talk about other areas of their life. I always ask everybody, tell me your life story. You know, I had a TV show once. It was a call-in show. And I took gang members from the Ickes Projects, which are torn down now. And I took these guys, and I would just went down into Ickes. I remember I was pregnant at the time, and I was just like, who want to be on TV? And so a bunch of them did. And I said, I just want you to tell your life story because I want the world to see you as human. Because when you hear where they came from, and their life stories are just full of so much trauma, so much violence, so much tragedy, so much death, so much lack of parental guidance because a lot of them, the parents are incarcerated or dead. And I'm like, how could you not care about them? I got a lot of crazy calls like that dumb man that called. I got a lot of those, trust me. Hell yeah. But, you know, that was kind of, has always been inside of me where I'm like, how in the world do I get the world to see all of God's children as God's children because that's what they are. And, but yeah, it's easy. They see the love in your eyes. They'll see it right away and they'll come to you. You know, well, people say they don't want to change. I'm like, no, that's an outright lie because I'm on the streets. And yeah, maybe not all of them, but I bet you 85% would like to do something else.
Well, if the government and the police department's really trying hard enough to get the gangs off the street, Melvin Carter.
First of all, we got to recognize where the real gang members are. They're in Congress.
Oh.
So,
I mean, the real gang members are where?
They're in Washington, D.C.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
To be honest with you, I mean, you know, if you really look at the track records. Because, our police department, yes, they're trying everything that they possibly can. And they understood a long time ago that we can't lock this problem out. We can't keep locking people up. You know, they get out, they come back, and they, you know, their brothers and their sisters are part of this culture. We've got to break the vicious cycle, and that's what we're doing here in Fort Worth, Texas. I can speak for the Fort Worth Police Department because I'm out there with them and I see what they're doing. Now, not all policemen are going to be they always tell me, they always tease me about my program. They say, "Here you come, that Hug a Thug program," you know, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. But if I help you keep the city safe, then we both got buy-in. All the guys that I know on the police force, my friends, they tell me, they say, Melvin, you know what I want to do every day? I want to get in my car. I don't want to write no tickets. I just want to drive around and not have to arrest anyone. And I want to go home and be with my kids. You know, it's a job. So now I would say 80% of the police department looks at it as a job, and they like people like us who are out there helping them to get rid of the problem. I made the comment about the about Washington. I hope nobody gets upset, but sometimes I can't see the bickering and the fighting that goes on between Congress. And they look at it and say, you know, what's the difference? I had a friend of mine one time. I had a kid come to me. I happened to be part of a fraternity. And he asked me, he said, so what's the difference in what you all do and what we do? And I was like, well, you know, the only thing I could actually tell this kid was we graduated from college. But he looked at the whole aspect of how fraternities operate. You know, we hate.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do? They jump people in. You know, we don't like the ones that wear certain colors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so he broke it all down to me, and then I had to go back to my fraternity and say, look, man, we've got to do something different, or we're getting lumped in with what the gangs are doing in our community. So we need to do something to reach out to our brothers and sisters. And this is one of the things that I would say across the board. Fraternities, sororities, after-school programs, churches, places,
Look, we're too isolated
mm-hmm.
in America. We're too isolated in the neighborhood. There's 62 churches on one side of town that I live on, and bottom line is nobody's saving nobody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the kids look at the church as a business now. So bottom line is we've got to, you know, I know I'm off track with the question, I'm standing on the soapbox, but we've got to do something to change the direction of our kids in our neighborhood. And I like your first call. Bottom line is keep it real. Stop lying to these kids, man.
Yep.
Stop sitting there painting this story about, you know, we didn't do this. I tell my personal kids the truth about me, and sometimes, you know, they don't even want to know the truth. They
mm-hmm.
like, look, man, that's a little too much, Dad. You know, could you hold off on? But I tell them the truth because the only way that they're going to understand, like I tell them, and I'll shut up, is that there's two types of people in the world. There's smart people and there's wise people. Smart people are people that go to school and read books. Wise people are individuals who live. So if you want to be a wise person, you've got to live. And you got to find somebody who has them so that you can learn from them and get wise thoughts. So I'll shut up with that. You know, let's find some wise people out there that we can go to.
LaFell Jackson, you were in a gang at one time. Were the police really trying to get rid of the problem? Was the government really trying to get rid of the gangs?
Well, I think that what I've seen when I was in the, you know, as a leader was our law enforcement, not all of them, became what they were sworn to help stop.
Ooh.
You know, you have to go back and do research and look at how the impact of the gangs had an impact of the police departments in California. All of them, most of them became corrupt. And they started doing the same thing that the gang members was doing. And so at that point, you know, you have to be mindful, and we have to continue to have debates and bring in law enforcement and have them come into our programs to work with our kids to stop our young men and women from being afraid of law enforcement and let them know what they're there for. And it'll also give our police officers an opportunity to realize that all young men and women that live in these communities are not hardened criminals and need to be locked up in the key threw away. So I think that at some point, yes, they've helped, but I think that without these debates and these talks and open sessions and bringing in good law enforcement, good, you know, people from the community, gang members, people from all across the country and the world, we won't make it there. But, you know, here it had an effect, and one thing that helped us here was a curse and a blessing for me. It cursed me to do the HBO documentary to shine a light on what was going on in this little state. But it takes more of that now because of the internet and we're able to show now what's going on. So law enforcement and government has to step up. It's kind of like they have to step up and either do two things. They step up and cover it up or step up and get involved. And
well,
I think that they're at some
the
point getting involved because I've been around the country now and worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Ohio to help them develop a program there for their gang members and stuff. And so I think that, yes, we see some that's stepping up and helping and playing a role of what they're supposed to do, but we still have so many others who believe that incarcerating and committing offenders is their job.
When you mm-hmm. did the HBO documentary, Gang War, Banging in Little Rock, what did that do for, I don't know, your ego? I mean, because they really featured you in that documentary, I felt. And you were out there doing what you were doing, leading that gang. Did you ever look back once the documentary aired and say, what am I doing?
Well,
or did
you
that
know,
just
at the end of the day, I was basically attacked for doing it.
Really?
The city right now, I still have problems that people, myself and even Steve Novojcik, we're hated when it comes to some government officials because they say we portrayed this state as just being a gang state. No, we just only shined the light on what was there. Now, I've learned that, like the young man said earlier. You know, if you're dealing with the youth, the gangs, before they get situated and grounded and cut out territory, you can do something about it. But once they've done that, then you just have to learn to live with it. And somewhat. So I didn't have an ego. My whole thing was I wanted to shine a light on how many young men and women that we had lost. Hey, people that I knew was dying day in, day out. You see them today, they're dead the next day. It just makes you wonder if, you know, if anybody really cared. So when I was approached to do the first one, of course, it was some part of me that was, you know, wanted to show a little bit off. But in down in my heart, I wanted some help. I wanted somebody to come in and help us do something about the problem. The second one, I played a big role in helping make that happen because I wanted to show 10 years later that, hey, we're still not where we should be after shining a light on all the violence we had back in 91 and 92.
Wow. Sally Hazelgrove, like I mentioned earlier, last year, I'll be honest with you, I am from Chicago, and I was afraid to travel to Chicago because of the gang violence I don't know if all of it could be attributed to gang violence, but all the murders that occurred in Chicago last year. How much of that was in your area?
You know, quite a lot of it, but I'll tell you, a lot of the murders are very senseless. I remember when this young man got murdered right behind the school I was working in, and
wow.
It was over a dice game. I believe it was $7.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, I'm against everybody being able to have a gun because I feel like that amendment is not applicable today. We are not in the Civil War, and I still personally don't understand it because I see how everybody, you know, guns are so accessible, as we all know. And I believe, though, there is a discord of such enchantments with our youth across the board, across all economical and social and race barriers, because I think youth, we have let them down incredibly by creating this society of materialism and, you know, as he said, we can't seem to join together, the churches, et cetera, the organization, everybody's so much out for themselves. That part of me kind of was not surprised last year, and I would just constantly pray, you know, for the children not to be shot, obviously, and killed. But you know where I live. I mean, I hear gunshots on a regular basis. Me and my daughters are walking home from school, and there's the police tape, and there's the blood on the streets, you know, and you become a little bit, I don't want to say desensitized, but it's like, well, this is the way the world is right now, you know, and to me it's going to continue until the world wakes up. And you know, I just wanted to comment on the question you said about the police, you know, how are they doing their job, et cetera. I believe the police are doing their job to their best abilities, and that's their job, you know, to find the criminals and lock them up, et cetera. I think I agreed. Somebody said, you know, we're trying to be the police. I'm like, yeah, that's not our job. Our job is to redeem, to help the police by redeeming this demographic of youth, by trying to change people. I see so many people in the community that'll talk about, you know, well, I'm gonna run off those gang members off my block. And I even got in an argument after church last Sunday with somebody where I said, you know, I'm like, but you're just trying to make them go serve on one block over. I said, so how does that help the problem? Why don't you talk to them? Why don't you reach out to them? She's like, well, they have a choice. And I said, well, have you always made the right choice? I'm like, and if you were that child in his shoes, I said, you know, and everybody's looking at you like that, well, you have a choice, and just judging you. I'm like, versus if you show love and kindness, it is harder for them to pull the trigger. Versus when we as adults look our nose down at them out of fear or misunderstanding, whatever, well, guess what? You're just rejecting them. So it's a little bit easier for me to pull that trigger. But if you come up to me out of nowhere, and I might think you're crazy, but and you're like, you know what? God bless you. I love you. God loves you. There's greatness in you. It might be a little harder to pull the trigger. I do not believe, you know, solving the problem should be put on the police. I'm like, the police have their job. We have our job. And our job, you know, we're not a socialistic country. The government isn't supposed to do everything. We want it to be democratic. Let's be democratic. Let's solve this problem as citizens. You know, that's how I feel.
We're down to our last 25 minutes. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for today's topic, gang violence. Are your colors worth dying for? Part two. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And again, press 1. I see the phone lines are jammed. I don't understand why y'all are not asking these people who have a wealth of knowledge questions about such a sensitive subject. I mean, we've got ex-gang leaders. We've got people who are working on the ground with kids who are in gangs, have been in gangs, or getting out of gangs. I mean, all the knowledge that you could possibly want on this particular subject. Also, a reminder, Mr. A.J. Houston is in the chat room today, so if you're listening via the Internet, post up your questions or comments in chat, and Mr. A.J. Houston will present them to the panel. Also, I don't remember how many years ago, First 48 Hours came out, and we saw, crimes being solved in 48 hours, and we saw, it's somewhat glamorized, if you will. I don't know if that's a good word for it, but everybody became a star. You would see Ray Ray on TV, as the police arrested him for whatever the crime was that he committed. Most of the times it's murder, or all of the times it seems to be murder. Are those types of programming helping or hurting the situation with gang violence? Melvin Carter, First 48, is it helping or is it hurting?
First 48, wow. First 48, First 72, all of those shows. I mean, I know we have freedom of speech, but a lot of the shows and a lot of the things that the media is portraying is causing a lot of the imagery that we see is causing a lot of issues. If I'm on first 48 hours, I become an instant star. If I've killed a rival gang member, all my buddies and everybody knows that I did it, so now I'm an instant success. People have the right to show and do, and you have the right to turn your TV on and watch it, I don't agree with a lot of the imagery that I see, but I'll say this to a parent, please, if you're gonna let them watch that, and I watch it with my kids, sit down and let's have an open discussion on what this person did, what's going on in this movie, what this rap group, my kids are notorious for riding with me, and in the car, one of the songs come on from the radio, and they're looking at me now laughing. But they start talking and they start rapping what the song is actually saying, and so I stop them in the middle of it and say, so you dancing on a pole now? Are you taking your clothes off? They're like, no, that's I'm just saying what the song say. No, actually you ingest this, what comes into your mental, what comes in that brain. It stays there. The subliminal message that person is sending you.
Yeah.
Do I need to be worried about you? Are you having sex now? Or because you're now repeating this. And I see this a lot on kids doing this on Facebook. They'll take a song and my kids do it. I was telling my kids they'll put the song on Facebook, and I always go back and check my kids, and I say, well, is that how you feel? Is that what's going on in your life? So First 48, we're not going to stop these shows. We're not going to stop any of those shows from being shown. Yes, they hurt. Yes. Yes, I do believe that they have a place, and they have their own place in society. But just educate yourself, and when those shows come on, sit down with your kids and get a chance to kind of go back and forth and find out where their head is, find out what they're doing and find out who their friends are.
Okay. Well, Phil Jackson, all the blood and the body laying on the street and the crying tape everywhere, First 48, too much, or is it helping or hurting the problem?
Well, once again, I'm going to agree with him. I think it's important to show our youth what could happen if they don't make right decisions. And you can show them any show. I mean, the kids watch so much television. First 48 would be is good, but you have to be there with the youth, and then you have to explain to them, you know, why this is on, the difference between reality and things that's not reality. And so it could be it's a balanced thing. It could hurt and it could actually help, because some kids can see these things and realize that, hey, and make a judgment. I don't want to be involved in that, you know. Or some kids can see it and they can get hyped over it. So it could be a two-edged sword, you know. But once again, it goes back to us being parents and sitting down with our kids and telling them the difference between what's reality and what's not, what you can put yourself into and what you can't. I did a show on the Judge Hatchett show not long ago when a young guy came from California who wanted to be a gang member. And in one day, we showed him his whole life, what his life would be like if he didn't stop doing what he was doing. Well, this kid has went on to go to college and now and do some good things. He just was under the impression because of the internet and television that he was really hard. But we took him and showed him some places, and our last stop was with a young lady named Marva Flowers out at her son's grave site.
Wow.
And all she had left for her baby was a picture.
Wow.
And that brought this young man to tears. And this young man he just couldn't take it. You know, that wasn't what he wanted to do. So it's going to, once again, the show could help in a manner, and it could hurt in a manner. But it's going to be up to us as a society and as, you know, leaders to explain to our youth the difference.
Okay. Sally, First 48, does it help or does it hurt?
You know, I'd say with the demographic of youth that we work with, their lives are like 48 hours. They've seen, the majority of them have seen people shot, have lost people in their family to gun violence. So I don't know how much it impacts them, to be honest, because violence is so much a daily part of our lives, and witnessing it is a daily part of your life. You know, I would just comment on that with our children, and because of the propensity of violence and with the rap lyrics, et cetera, I mean, I'm guilty of liking rap music, but I constantly have to change the radio station or just turn it off because of the lyrics. And I have two little girls, and, you know, one day they're singing, bottoms up, and I was like, oops, my bad. And you have to, in this world, in the society we've created, we have to learn as adults to sacrifice. I love Law and Order. I love crime shows. But I no longer watch them if my children are around, because they see enough living in Inglewood, and I've realized that, you know, I have to make sacrifices regardless of what I like. For instance, if I like certain music, but, you know, the lyrics are not appropriate for children. So much out there is not appropriate for our youth. As far as if it helps or hurts, I don't really feel that I can comment on that. As I said, you know, I don't know that a TV show ever stopped me from doing something. These kids know it's going to end in death or prison. They're the first ones to tell you. I've always said that's how desperate they are for unconditional love and a sense of belonging. They're willing to risk it. They know. They know where it's going to end. When people come at them and say, you're going to die or be in prison, it's like, well, I know. That's when my brother's dead. You know, my father's in prison. But I'm like, wow, that's how desperate we all need to feel loved and valued, and as children especially. And if we don't provide it, the gang will. Of course they will.
You know, to piggyback off what you said, how many funerals have you all attended as a result of gang violence? We'll start with Mr. LaFell Jackson. How many funerals have you attended as a result of gang violence?
Well, you know, I can't count them.
Wow.
They're like, it's like, how many times have I... oh my goodness, I can't count them. There's been so many funerals that I've become, you know, I don't know if it was at first, if it's like just for me to go through that so I could be able to help people deal with it, but sometimes I can go into a funeral and I don't feel anything anymore because I've been to so many.
Mm-hmm.
Here just recently, I lost a young lady who was so close to me, and it wasn't for gang violence. And believe it or not, that hurt more than I can even imagine, and I couldn't go to the funeral. So I've been to so many that I had became to where I would go just to be the person there to help support because I didn't feel anything.
Well, did you lose any of your gang members to gang
violence?
I lost
so many. And if you think about it, in the HBO documentary, Back to the Hood, the young man, they call him Blue, but he said he didn't want to be called Blue anymore. He called me to the hospital, and he did an interview there, and he told the kids, I asked him to tell the kids what he thought, you know, in being involved in a gang would do to them, and he told them. And then he turned over, and he went into a coma, and 2 weeks later he died. Mm. His last words was that. You know, and so I've been to so many, and I've lost so many friends and homeboys and you know, people around me that, like she said, I became desensitized to how it's supposed to feel to lose someone.
Wow, that's incredible. Melvin Carter, have you lost any of the young people that you deal with out in the Boys and Girls Club as a result of gang violence?
I would like to say this, that I've probably been to more funerals than I've been to graduation.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So,
wow.
It's we all know. We know the problem. We know the situation. We know what's out there. And we know the outcome. I mean, but you view yourself as hopeless. You know, my kids do. They don't see themselves. I think when we call the guest said, you know, I didn't see myself getting past 18, 19 years old. This is what we're dealing with. So, I mean, I would not do some of the things, but why wouldn't I live a dangerous lifestyle? And then, you know, we've got other things that that basically entice us to not do the right thing, but, you know, to get involved in violence. But, yeah, I would say that anyone that does this work, yes, you've been to a few funerals in your day.
Wow. Sally, you've been to many funerals working with the youth that you do?
You know, I kind of made a decision that I can say one thing. I've been blessed that the youth that I'm involved with, that all of them are still alive.
Wow.
And there have been youth that I worked with over the past 10 years, though, that have died as a result of gang violence. And the last funeral I went to, you know, I just wept, of course, and these people comforted me that didn't even know me. And I kind of made a decision, and that verse went through my head where I was like, okay, I'm here to serve God, leave the dead with the dead. So now when somebody dies and they'll be like, so-and-so died, Sally, and so-and-so, remember him, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm so sorry to hear that, but I don't go to all the funerals anymore. I feel like I have to stay on my thing of focusing on the living and moving forward, and I pray every night, God, don't let any of my babies be taken. Keep them all safe. Keep a shield of protection around them, these small children and stuff. And so, because there's just so many of them dying. You know, we have the makeshifts, of course, you know, the little memorials all over the place. And I have many godsons, and one of my godsons had picked me up the other day, and he's like, look, that Sean died yesterday, and blah, 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 and this and that. And you do get a little desensitized. I hate to say that, but you know, and I wouldn't say, like, I know if I go to any funeral, I'm going to cry. But as far as I would say desensitized in that, I'm like, well, that's another funeral, but I've got so much work to do. And I've got to move forward with the living, and you know what I mean? Trying to prevent any of my children and these kids, keeping them safe.
Wow. LaFelle Jackson, when law enforcement arrested you and you went to prison for whatever, drug trafficking and the other charges, do you feel like they tried to blame you for everything that every member of your gang had ever done, or was it just about you?
Well, of course, I do believe that some did, but at the end of the day, I found out when I went to federal court that they only wanted me, okay, to the extent that they were prepared to close out other indictments and let other people go if I was to plead to my charge.
Wow.
So I was the top of the thing. And back at that time, they wasn't really in, they were still going off of the things from, you know, the Zero Tolerance Task Force thing out of California, and it was like, take off the head and you'll kill the body. Well, now they know that's not true. As you take off the head, the body sprouts other heads, which are probably a lot more violent than the head. So, you know, I think that Some of them did, and most of them probably still do. But a lot of them knew that, you know, at the end of the day, I was responsible for what I was responsible for. And but they knew I had did a lot more, though. But they only charged me for what I was caught for.
Wow. To each of you, what would you say to a child who may be listening, who is being influenced to possibly join a gang? What would you tell them in terms of what kind of skills, what kind of verbal language can you give them to offset whatever they may be hearing from the gang who may be trying to get them to join? Melvin Carter.
I would say to that child, first of all, don't go down that road. It's not a road that you want to go down, because once you go down that road, there's no going back. You can get your help and whatnot, but please, do not go down that road. There's nothing good that's going to come out of it. You're either going to be six under, or you're going to be incarcerated. And then you have to deal with a whole set of new issues. Be young. You know, love life, love yourself, have fun. If you're a kid now, please believe it. I tell my own personal kids, when you start paying bills and paying mortgages, you'll understand what I was going through when you all were young. But just be young, be full of life. You can be anything you want to be. You can be the next president of the United States. But do you, and do you well.
Wow. Sally, what would you tell a child that was, you know, possibly thinking about joining a gang? What kind of language would you tell them to offset what they may be hearing from someone that's trying to recruit them?
I would tell them what I always first say, which is, you know, I see greatness in you in leadership. You know, I love you and God loves you. You're God's child, but you have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. I'm like, now, if the choice is to either join the gang, and, you know, it's so hard for when you ask that question, because I have a little way I operate. I take kids to eat a lot if they're real high risk and somebody tells me that they're about to go do something. But I would focus on the positive first and foremost, and then I would tell them, you have a choice here, you know, and I'm going to ask you to trust me and to choose God and to choose doing the right thing, and don't choose going down that path, because we both know where it ends, because if they're thinking about it, they know where it ends. And then I would ask them, what can I do for you? What do you need right now? You know, if you find out there's a reason they're lured, there's a reason, and it's usually they're aching for that sense of belonging and purpose. You know, we all need a purpose. I always ask kids, what's your dream? What's your dream? And, you know, this is my dream, you know, and I'll fight with everything I have in it to reach it. What's your dream? And I encourage them that. You know, so if your dream is to one day be, say, a rapper, you know, or a dancer, then you have to do what it takes to make that dream happen. And by joining the gang, you know, you're creating the possibility of that dream can never happen. And I would just be heartbroken if you got shot or killed or ended up in juvenile probation or the juvenile detention center. You know, and so you got to reach out. And it's the constant reaching out. You know, I always say when I get to that point that I can hire people to mimic what I do, they have to be willing to have that 24/7 with them, meaning your phone can ring at 4 in the morning from a kid and you're going to answer it.
Wow.
Because I feel that's what's helped me to make such a big difference is the availability of myself. I keep myself availability. I go to their homes when there's a fight in their house, you know. I go to their schools when they're having a problem. If they've gotten in trouble with the law, you know, I'll try to go and intercede. But most of the time they're calling and they're feeling low and they're feeling a little lonely and they need somebody just to talk to and just remind them how important they are. If you don't feel important, you feel like you have nothing to lose.
Wow. LaFell Jackson, if a child is, as Steve Novacek puts it, a member of the 5-H Club, helpless, hopeless, homeless, hungry, and hugless, what kind of language do they use to keep from being recruited? Because they're at risk, obviously, if they are in the 5-H Club. What kind of language do you give them to tell the gang that's trying to talk to them? But before you answer that, I want you to tell us what you would say to them, because you were yourself an ex-gang leader, what would you be saying to that child, first of all, to try to recruit them, and then tell us the language that they could use to counter what you used to say to kids you were trying to recruit?
Well, first of all, my language, my recruiting for them was I would show them how I was living, the nice car, and then I would show them the money, and I would ease them in by having them to get some of it. You know, at one time I had about 20 people in my neighborhood that had on walkie-talkies that were telling me when law enforcement would come, coming, and I was hiring those kids like this, so they were making money. That's the way I was recruiting locally. Now, what I would also tell them is that, you know, under the conspiracy laws, they're a part of the crime, whether they're caught with any dope or not. And I was one time, and to quote, I'm going to give you a couple quotes from one of our news reporters as being one of the most dangerous men in the country. And that's what he said when he opened up, one of LaFell Jackson. Well, they know I've been there. And for me, just to be there talking to them, is one of the biggest things that I could do is just be there. They see me doing something different. Sometimes our kids need us to show them versus tell them. They get talked to so much about what they shouldn't do and should do, and people are not following the examples. So my example is my biggest word. And at that, I also want to go with just about two small quotes
okay.
that come from my thoughts in a little manual that I wrote, okay?
Okay.
And one of them is, and this goes back to, as I talked to you about, you know, myself kind of looking out the barrel of a gun, going to shoot someone.
I wish you'd tell that story, but okay, go ahead.
In the hard rain,
and I had
to scope on
them. And
I never forget, I felt something, and I looked up, and it was a dog. He was sitting there looking at me like, what are you finna do?
That was an angel.
And I looked over, and as I thought this rain was pouring down my face, I realized it was tears.
Mm.
And if, you know, and I got up, and I had a high-powered rifle, and I was left because whatever this dog said to me, he said it to my heart, you know. And I got up, and I left. And right now, one of the persons that I had that gun pointed at, we became friends. He was a blood. We became friends. What if I would have shot? You know, so it's easy to pull the trigger one time. It's really easy to pull a trigger and shoot and kill somebody. Easiest thing in the world to do. The hardest thing in the world for me was to raise my daughter as a single parent. And for the last 7 years, let me tell you, that's been the hardest thing in the world to do. So I guess to tell a young man, to beat that, I show them.
Mm-hmm.
I show them in my day-by-day things of what I do. I get up and I go to that center, rain, sleet, or snow, and I work with young men and women that they know. And out of that, when I say, hey, you know, you're doing the wrong thing, I have no reply. You know, oh, okay, OG, okay, Mr. Jackson, and they go on. And I want to quote one thing
quickly
with them. You know, I believe, and this come out of my thought books, I've been taught that the greatest war fought is without casualties.
Wow.
When we teach our kids to fight their wars without anyone getting hurt, then we've succeeded in what we're trying to do.
Okay, LaFell Jackson, tell them how to reach you if they'd like to help your organization, ROCAN.
You can reach me by, you can go to my Facebook, which is on LaFell Jackson, or you can send me a letter to P.O. Box 2368, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72203. Or you can give us a call at 501-247-7401.
Sally Hazelgrove, tell them how to reach you if they'd like to help your organization Restoring the Path program.
Sure. They can go to the website, which is www.restoringthepath.org. And there is a donate page there with the mailing address. Any checks are made out to Restoring the Path, sent to St. Sabina, and that's at 1210 West 78th Place in Chicago, 60620. And if they want to contact me, there's also a contact page on there, which gets sent to my email address.
Okay. Melvin Carter, how do they reach you?
I'm always on the mobile, 817-944-3334. I pick the phone up anytime, any day or night. You can reach me at, if you have a website, Boys and Girls Sisters Radio Fort, but you can reach me at my email address, mcarter@fortworthkids.org.
Okay, I'd like to say thank you to my guest, Ms. Sally Hazelworld with Restoring the Past Program, Mr. Melvin Carter, Director of the Boys and Girls Club in Fort Worth, Texas, Mr. Robert Lewis, Jr., he's with Street Safe Boston, and Mr. LaFell Jackson with Rose out of Little Rock, Arkansas. A reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or our host. A reminder, next week's show, that will be February 5th, our guest will be Jordan Maxwell. And if you would follow us on Twitter, AJ Houston is AJ Houston on Twitter, and I'm Carrie Hines on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook under the same. We'd also like to, again, remind everybody to pray for Egypt. We are looking for, hopefully, a peaceful resolution to all of that. And on behalf of AJ and myself, we'd like to say thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.